All right, friends, welcome to the Mentality of Combat Sports. David Mullins, Robin Black. He's David Mullins, MMA on Twitter. His website's David Mullins Sports Psychology. He is a sports psychology consultant. He worked with SBG.
Lots of guys.
Other athletes.
All over the world.
I wanted to get into other sports, but then I thought I wanted to, but I don't. Combat sports is my thing. Mm-hmm. And when I got into other sports and working with some other athletes, and there are some guys that I have good relationship with now, and I keep going working with those guys, but it's just not the same for me. And combat sports is what I want to focus on. So that's MMA mostly, but some boxers and jiu-jitsu guys, some wrestlers.
I concentrate on combat sports too. I don't analyze football or baseball or hockey or tennis or golf or any of these things. And I think specialization and understanding what your specialties are allows you. You have this many hours in the day.
Yeah.
So it'll allow us to specialize, to go deeper, to study more, to have more pinpointed knowledge in something.
Yeah.
You know, so that's interesting. So if you have watched our show before, last week we had John Kavanaugh on, which was really fun. And thank you to the Mac Life for sharing it, and Connor too. That was really fun. We learned a lot from John. It was fun having a guest. We were hoping to have one this week, but maybe next week. Maybe next one. We were looking at an expert in the art of nutrition and weight cutting because of the huge component that the huge psychological component of cutting weight.
There's so much to that. That's for me, and we'll get into that when we have him on. But for me, what I do with fighters, that's a big part of it too, is managing the discipline around the weight cut and the mood around when they're starting to restrict calories and all the different things that are there around it. So there's a lot mentally going on. It's not just a matter of eating XYZ.
Yes, we'll get into that. George Lockhart. Okay, George Lockhart is like the foremost expert in this. We know that from many fighters directly. I've observed friends that are fighters who are the guy's level of understanding and awareness, and you talk about specialization like that. So, and we've been in touch with him, and he had expressed interest in coming on. But go ahead and hit him up on Twitter and stuff and remind him to come on next week. George, we're looking forward to talking to you. So we got stuff to talk about today, and there's a reality of television or podcasting or whatever, where by the time people are watching this, CM Punk may have already been choked out and or won by guillotine. Mm-hmm. And Stipe will either still be the champion or Overeem will be the new champion. So we can touch on it. But what things were you thinking about today, or what things have you been focusing in on or interested in?
So it's funny, but you would imagine the heavyweight title fight is the most fascinating fight. But for me, the CM Punk Mickey Gall fight, from a mental perspective, it is just fascinating.
It is.
It really is. And again, this is before the fight, so we don't know what happened. So everyone's going to watch this after and know.
More people will watch this after than before.
Yes. Way more. So everyone knows what happened. But this is our thoughts beforehand, and it really is fascinating, I think. Mm-hmm. Just get rid of the bias around wrestling sucks, and I'm not a wrestling fan. I don't care for it at all. But that's not what this is about for me. Get rid of the thing that this is a freak show fight, shouldn't be happening in the UFC, and all this kind of stuff.
To this,
but just if you put yourself in the shoes of both guys, this is a big night for both of those guys. You know, just for a second, people just take the chance to think about what CM Punk has put himself, the position he's put himself in, the risk he's taken to put himself there, and Mickey Gall in the same situation. There's a lot of pressure on both guys, and it's a different kind of pressure. And the way I've been looking at it is it's a good fight to kind of explain the difference between the need to achieve and the need to avoid failure, which are two personality traits that people have. Some will exhibit more of the need to achieve. Some will exhibit more of the need to avoid failure.
Are they always connected? They are along the same spectrum, right?
Yeah, they are. They are very different, though. Yeah. I mean, and people will have, parts of both, and different scenarios will either increase one or decrease the other or whatever. So they sound like the same thing, you know. But the need to achieve is kind of focused on the success and what you can get done. The need to avoid failure is focusing on avoiding any negatives of failing and losing.
Well, the best way to do that is don't start or try at all.
Yeah, that's what most do. Most people exhibit that need to avoid failure, and by definition, they don't try at all. So then you don't fail,
mm-hmm. But you certainly don't achieve either.
You don't. Yeah, but some people aren't driven by that need to achieve. Right. They're driven by the need to avoid failure, which is embarrassment. Looking stupid in front of others, being evaluated by others, being criticized—that that's what people are. A lot of people are driven by.
Yeah, this has been something we've talked about a lot. It's of personal interest to me because I'm always curious about. I always feel really bad for people who don't start things that they wish they started, and then 2 years later they say they might do it soon. I always feel bad for them. But so the need to avoid failure, if it's strong enough. And it's our driving force. We just won't start.
Yeah.
That would be
the best way. The extreme example.
Yeah. If we have some need to avoid failure, mm-hmm. Naturally, whoever you are, without working on yourself or studying, whatever, you have some need to avoid failure, which all people have to some degree,
yeah.
But you have a stronger need to achieve, that will get you started at least.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the good way. That's a great way of looking at it, is the balance between the two. Mm-hmm. So the need to achieve and the need to avoid failure. If the balance is more towards the achieve, then, the traits that the people exhibit are things like, you want challenges that are exciting challenges, that are, you take risks more, you put yourself out there more, you're willing to take on criticism, you want feedback, you blame yourself if you're wrong, that those kind of traits are there. In terms of sports and athletes, and fighters in particular, they take on challenges where it's like 50-50 or a little bit in their favor, or they're the underdog. Those kind of challenges that are really challenges, whereas the people with the need to avoid failure will take on ones where there's very little chance of losing or there's very little chance of winning. So then
make
an excuse.
When you're the massive underdog, you're the 0-5 guy and you're fighting.
You're not really
going to
fail if you lose.
Yeah, I mean, they expected me to fail. So I really didn't risk anything.
Yes.
I came in and did exactly what was expected of me, but I showed up and look at me.
Yeah,
I gave it my best.
Exactly.
So really interesting.
And the other things that the need to avoid failure people take on is they don't like being evaluated or analyzed or critiqued. They blame external things, even for success and failures. Lots of excuses, not taking on the challenges that the others would take. And we'll get more into that maybe through the eyes of this fight with Punk and Gall, because if we just for a sec take away the outcomes and what they benefit from it, if you just look at the challenge that both guys took on, CM Punk took on the challenge of fighting in the UFC. Mm-hmm. He seeked that challenge out. He sought it out big time.
And I observed this about him. It's something when Rogan and I were talking about him months back.
Yeah.
I made an observation along the line. He went out of his way before he fought. He never trained striking at all, which for somebody who says a lifetime dream of martial arts, that's odd.
Yeah, that's very strange.
You try and you're afraid to get started for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. He also said, I'm a white belt for life.
Yeah.
That would be a way
to touch on that.
I don't get graded. Therefore, I'm not even going to get graded. I mean, I could be any belt.
Yeah.
But, and like the desire to avoid grading, he also went in and they said, well, what about the Ultimate Fighter? And he said, well, I don't see if that's the right way for me. That Ultimate Fighter is a way you will be heavily observed. So he had tendencies of avoiding failure. You saw them plain as day early on. Also, oddly, pro wrestling and going out and being booed becomes something that you say, see, I want it to be booed.
Mm-hmm.
Something that is a failure if you allow it to seem like one. In the world of pro wrestling, you don't fail. Together we created a story. You won and I lost, and they booed and they hated me. Job well done.
Yeah.
There's a weird...
It's easier to be hated, I suppose, like that. I was definitely the same mindset as you with that mm-hmm. stuff, especially the I'm a white belt for life.
Yeah. That's an avoidance of being graded.
And it is, and it's kind of a... it's a lack of accepting of I'm a white belt, mm-hmm. and the reason I'm a white belt is because I'm at white belt level.
Yeah,
you know. But he, I don't know if you watched the show. I'm a sucker for those shows. Yeah. I love that stuff. I will watch those. I like HBO 24/7 and all the different stuff. I just lap those up. I love them.
Yeah.
And this was a pretty good one. You know, for what it is, it's a promo for a fight and everything, but good behind the scenes stuff. And it was good. He got graded on the show. He got his first stripe on his on his white belt.
And he was happy about it.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course he was. You know, he had worked for that, and getting that first grading is, you know, it's a great step when you're doing jiu-jitsu and everything. So he, you know, he's not a white belt for life anymore. You know,
he's a one stripe or multiple stripes. If you didn't see the episodes, if they didn't shoot it in other episodes, he could have been.
He might have got a few more stripes, or he might be a blue belt. Who knows? But so I think what you're saying is correct at the start, but then he's here now.
Yeah,
you know, so there is a bit of that where
I wasn't saying he is that way. Because we don't subscribe to anyone's anyway forever.
Yeah.
I was saying that he had some of that at the beginning,
sure.
Which is not surprising. We might all feel some of those feelings.
And I think at the start it might have been a lack of understanding of what actually was the challenge really was. You know, there's all this footage of him from years ago tapping Hinner out, but that wasn't real.
That's not real.
Like
he can't. That's not real. You see, even him rolling later on, he's a white belt. He's not. I mean, I've studied jiu-jitsu for 9 years. Hinner would tap me every 12 seconds for as long as
he would tell me what he was going to do and still do it.
Exactly. I mean, but if you play, that's a way of not really studying jiu-jitsu. Get somebody so good and then do little TV things with them and get a taste for it.
Yeah.
But again, it's not. You shouldn't judge that because we may all feel that way. It's not an unnatural way to feel.
Yeah. But once he realized what the challenge really was, and he got to actually taste some competitive sparring, and he's still there now, and you know, actually going to, right, by the time people are watching, he would have done the fight, I presume.
We some can only people presume. Will see this before.
He would have done it, hopefully, yeah. So
hopefully it goes well. You know, it's a big challenge.
But it is a big challenge he's taken on, right? Yeah. Like, that is a big challenge. To take a fight in the UFC is a big, big challenge. So that's his challenge, which is, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot, a big risk involved there in some ways. When you're a high-profile guy in something else and you're putting a bit of a reputation on the line, and you know the way the backlash is going to be. Mm-hmm. Whereas, and this is, I totally get what Mickey Gall was doing. He's got a jump into the UFC that he would never have got, but he called out a guy who'd never fought before.
Right.
You know, that was his, never had an amateur fight, never done anything before. So that was his. And again, I get it.
Yeah.
I totally get why you would do that. Like, from a marketing perspective and from an opportunity, there's, you know, there's not many chances like that for a guy who was 0-0 as a pro, right? I think that's what he was.
He became 1-0 before he ended.
Yeah, yeah. So he was 0-0 as a pro. So you don't get a shot in the UFC unless there's something like this. So he grabbed that, but he was calling out a guy who had never fought before. So it is a little bit of a less risky challenge, if you want.
Very low risk, very high reward. So
yes.
I'm going to jump in here. So I fought at 38 years old, and mm-hmm. I trained for a couple of years. Literally, I had the exact same experience.
That's what I was
going to
touch on as well later.
Yeah, and I can tell you, I've insight into it. There's beautiful things about it, and we can touch on that later. But the one part I will tell you is when I was 0-0, 0-1, 0-2, 1-2, 2-2, you know, winning, losing, being proven to be an even lower test, an even less skilled or dangerous opponent, I had more and more people call me out. And I didn't have the same understanding, but between empathy and analysis, I could see some were just, you know, very, very, very talented guys who had fought the best in the world and were 10-3 and like, let me smash that guy. They weren't looking for easy. But others were guys who feared risk.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to go in and fight somebody who would beat them. Some that called me out at the time never fought a tough opponent ever in their life.
Oh, there's loads of those guys out there.
Lifetime, and I was the ultimate one. I was old. I was started training at 36. I had lots. Easy to beat, but a high payoff. And I could feel their fear of real contests. And this week, like, and it was a week. weak. And I took it, and I took any of the hate and any of the ridicule, and I knew that it would lead to other things in my life, and I would get a lot out of it, but I was ridiculed. But I could feel the weakness in some of them, just the true weakness in people, the bully mentality, you know, who would never really look or challenge somebody as good or the 50-50 or 55-45, but they would look at a 40-year-old guy with two losses and they wanted to fight him. You know, I can feel the weakness.
For sure. I mean, I can kind of relate to it just from watching in the gym training when you, at the end, everyone's lined up at the end of class, like by belt order or, you know, by ranking or whatever. Yeah. And sometimes in different gyms I've trained in now over the years, sometimes the coach will say, okay, he'll ask you, who do you want to pick a guy? Who do you want to go with? And you see people either looking left or looking right. You know, up this direction is black, brown, purple, blue.
Yeah. Higher blue, higher white, whatever.
Yeah. Down here are the newbies and a few stripes on their white belt and stuff. And you see people. They'll have a quick glance and they're over here, or they're straight over there,
right.
And they're the same people who are taking rounds off during sparring. You know, they're sitting out. And they're
only rolling with the brand newest guy. Only every day beat up the new guy.
Or you'll find them taking the black belt or the brown belt.
Right.
You know?
A loss that's okay to take.
Yes, exactly. Right. No expectation. And I see that all the time, and I know what's happening when I see that.
Of course.
And it's always interesting to me. And you get a kind of an idea of where people are coming from early on when you start to see that kind of stuff.
Yeah, true.
So I'm not saying that's what Mickey Gall is doing, because
it has elements of that.
But it does have a little bit of that. Now, again, I have to stress, it's a great opportunity for him, and it would kind of be silly of him not to take it, because someone was going to get it, so why not him? But there's other paths there, the traditional path of, you know, building up your record, getting onto the Ultimate Fighter or whatever it might be. There are elements to that, right? When you look at it, it could be perceived like that. And then the risk, if that is true, if there is that need to avoid failure more so than the need to achieve.
If things
get a little bit tougher, if it gets into the second round, who knows? You know, if
nobody's expecting that necessarily, including him.
Yeah.
So all the more reason for, if it gets there, for him to be like, this isn't how we're supposed to.
Yeah, and that spiral, that negative mental spiral, can kick in, and it can take the top of the top level fighters. You know, it can hit them. We saw it with Conor against Nate in the first fight. It can just go from 100 to 0 really, really quickly. We've seen that in loads of different fights. So that can happen.
Now,
that
if
is
you're
a risk.
Watching this on Sunday or Monday, and one of these guys finishes the other in 25 seconds, that doesn't make any of this. That removes this part of the potential path, but this is still true. These are still things that must be acknowledged and dealt with by each guy in advance of ever finding themselves in this situation.
Exactly. That's the key for me here, is that this is this needs to be dealt with in the build up by both guys. Like, so if I was working with one and working with the other, we'd address those issues. We would have been doing it for weeks.
And
the best way to handle that is to change what the task is. You know, instead of it being based on the opponent and the perception of the opponent and the level of the opponent and getting the win and stuff, it becomes about performance then.
Yeah.
And when it's about performance, there's much less of a risk of falling into those traps.
If I'm asking myself to perform at my best, failure is I didn't perform at my best.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that is, fucking perform at your best. You know, on some level, it's more complicated than that, but at least when we lay it out, if it's like, I've got to do this, or I've got to win, or I've got to, you know, there's going to be ups and downs through it. But the ups and downs, when my only assignment is being the best me, that's an achievable assignment when the downs are there.
Yeah.
And when the ups are there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to it. I mean, like I said, it would have been happening for weeks with me working through that with different guys. And that need to achieve, the high need to achieve level guy, the risk for him when he gets matched up with someone who he perceives to be of a much, much lower level of him is complacency. You know, it's not being hungry for it, not being motivated for it. And then the performance can dip because of that.
Or I would expect that you have the need to achieve something spectacular. Mm-hmm. So you've got to go out and do jumping spinning kicks. Uriah Hall froze because of his need to achieve in those early fights. Winning wasn't going to be enough achievement for him. Yeah. It had to be, you know, the spinning hook kick to the head. It had to be the single punch thing. And so he froze. It's like, I either got to do something amazing or nothing at all. And he did nothing at all until he turned that corner and figured that out. That's really interesting.
He's starting to put it together now. Yeah. He's got a fight with Derek Brunson coming up, which is a great fight.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
But there's a lot to it, and there's a lot to, for me working with guys, to be aware of the way different guys are maybe the way they're looking at the challenge that's coming up, and little signs of things creeping in, whether that's, you know, the need to avoid failure is coming in based on circumstances, and it is very situational. It's not just exclusive to this fight, far from it. It's could be a guy who's lost two in a row, and if he loses the next one, he's going to be cut by the UFC or whatever it might be. Or the guy who he's been told by Sean Shelby or Joe Silva, if you win this one, we'll most likely get you in. That risk of losing now is huge. There's a lot on the line, so they can shut everything down, and it becomes a little bit more cautious. And
John Jones, OSP.
Yeah. There's a lot on the line for him there, and things get shut down, and it becomes a little bit restricted, limited.
That's an interesting thought. At every single scenario, something's at play like that, and we see now. You know, we'll sit at a desk and all day long we're talking about fighting and putting out these different observations and perspectives. And one that comes up, Ram Dean mentioned it today. You got to look good. Like, you can't just go out there and get a decision. You got to go out there and really put on a spectacular performance.
Yeah.
That sometimes has got to be, it's a hard enough assignment to go out there and be in the mindset and be free to perform and fight to your best. Never mind without the added pressure of being spectacular.
Yeah. I mean, you would want guys to want to be that, though, to embrace the pressure of that. And that, to me, is a better thing than going and beating this guy and getting the win.
But how do we find the pocket between we are going to do that, but not at excessive risk?
Yeah. And it happens all the time where, like you said, Uriah Hall is probably a good example where he's got to win by a spin and hook kick. Or else what's the point? That can happen with lots of guys. I think Tony Ferguson's fight with Fanada recently is another good example of something like this, where Tony's he was supposed to fight Habib, and he was supposed to be like a number one contender fight, and all of a sudden he's getting a debutant.
And
potentially, that, you know, Fanada might be a featherweight, really, not a lightweight. And he's coming in with, you know, a big... Tony's got to look spectacular in that fight then, you know? That's the expectation there, not just beat this guy.
Blow him out of the water.
That's what was there. You know, that's what it felt like in the build-up, that's what's expected from him.
And Groovy Lando's like, hey, man, if I have an awesome fight and show my heart and go for it, it's a payoff no matter what. Yeah. So you're almost bringing to him what he came for.
Yeah. You know? So for Ferguson, in the build-up and whoever else in the build-up in similar different fights, my job when working with someone in that kind of a situation, and I've had a few guys in fights like that where it's maybe not the fight they wanted or the fight they expected, and it's a lower level guy or it's a guy they don't have as high a perception of and stuff. It's about managing that big time. So that it's not about going out there and just blowing them away. That's not a spectacular performance. You know, it doesn't need to end with a spectacular finish for it to be a spectacular performance. There's a big difference for me. It's about, like we talk about, and I'm talking about performance with guys, we talk about all different areas of the game. You know, like in terms of their movement, their defense, the in between with the striking and the grappling, the against the fence stuff, the on top and on off their back, and every different phase of the game, what they want to get done. It doesn't need to go out. You don't need a 13-second KO someone for it to be a spectacular performance. It can be spectacular in many, many different ways. Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about spectacular performance with guys. It doesn't need to be. People don't need to jump off their seats and go crazy with it, you know. Yeah. And when you're focusing on delivering your best in all those different areas and truly putting in a performance that matches what you're capable of putting in and actually goes above what you were capable of putting in. So you break through that ceiling that you've had. That's the real goal. So then whether you're fighting Groovy Lando or Habib, it doesn't really matter then.
True.
You know?
In the end... fighting is such
Lando's great though.
He's, yes,
you know, he's,
we called a couple of his old fights. We called one of his fights in Pancras. Within a week or two of that fight, we went back and found it and commentated it. And he was pretty special then. So he's going to be a real. But he can't just sit around and go, well, look, I'm already here, or feel the pressure of having such a great open. He's got to go back and figure out what got him there and make sure that he can perform that way. Always. You know? His life is different now. His position in life is different. Now he's a guy with a spectacular UFC debut. Before that, he was a guy who wanted to be in the UFC. Many things changed with that situation.
For sure. And I feel like he did go out there and he gave it his very best shot. But that's a risk of a guy coming in. Like Daryl Horcher had it against Habib too recently. There's been a few examples of things like this where low level compared to the perception of the guy they're facing. You know, that's the reality of the situation. But you want that guy to believe that he has a chance if it's really there, and you know, if he has a chance, he can't just be that risk of avoiding failure kind of thing where I'll go out there and give it my best shot. It's like the white belt going against the black belt. I'll go out there and I'll give it my best shot. I'm going to lose, but I'll lose with dignity, and it can't be that either. You have to trust the matchmakers in the UFC that they're going to put you in a position where the fight's winnable. And if that's true, then you got to go and put in the performance that you're capable of, and don't be held back by your perception of the opponent.
There's a couple of things I want to talk about related to that. And one is a bunch of guys who are champions somewhere else, and one of them will win and fight the best fighter in the world. That's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Another thought, just it's related to mindset and mentality and psychology and stuff. When presented with the idea, you're Duke or any of the other coaches, and you're presented with the idea of you have, at that time it was probably 18 months to get somebody ready. Do you know who Tim Ferriss is?
Yeah.
So Tim Ferriss.
I love his podcast.
Yeah. Great stuff. And he wrote the 4-Hour Workweek, and he did a web series on learning things very quickly. So he learned to swim in a couple of days. He hacked how to learn a language so he could learn 4 or 5 languages by compressing it down to some things. There's a bunch of stuff. He learned to cook, the 4-Hour Chef. Like he studied the meta learning of taking something. He learned to play guitar quickly.
Yeah.
You know, you're not the same guitar player, but if you hack it down to what are the fundamental key roots of being able to be a guitar player, so you hack that.
Yeah.
When we were presented with, whether it's myself in retrospect years ago, knowing what I know now, or CM Punk when he goes in and says, I'd like to do this, or the next guy in the future. Because what a lot of people who are just UFC fans don't realize, this story has been told many times
on many different
TV stories. You've seen one in Ireland, and there was one in Australia, and there was one in Halifax.
And there was one
in
Robin Black.
Exactly. They made little TV shows to watch a guy go and learn to fight. The difference is he's doing it in a big stage, and they finally found somebody that is worth doing from a financial standpoint for them to do it.
Yeah.
But if we were to go back and do that now, and rather than say, okay, what were our goal as the people shaping you and you as the person in it is to make you capable of competing in a professional mixed martial arts fight. And that is the goal, and that's what everybody has prepared.
Yeah.
What if we hacked that and said, our goal is to make you win a professional mixed martial arts fight? That's not the same as training you to be the best martial artist you can in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, a lifetime.
Yeah.
That is slowly building on all of the skills and all of the structures. We do it if we want to learn piano. We learn scales. We do it whatever we want to learn. We learn the foundation. But there are ways that people hack this. And I just wonder if we looked at it and said, we have 2 years, how well can we make you box? And how well can we teach you to wrestle and work the cage and work open guard? This much. Well, we can still work on that, but let's work on another thing, and that is one single route to victory.
Yeah, a path.
A path.
Yeah.
We're going to create a path for you that for 2 years you're going to work that path.
Yeah.
And that path ends with a guillotine, let's say.
Yeah.
And that path requires to get a guillotine, we need your head down. And to get your head down, we need the clinch, and we need our hand here. And to do that, we've got to close the distance, and to do that, we've got to line you up. And we work back from our path, we reverse engineer how we finish you in a guillotine back down the path to how we start the fight. And while we're developing all your other skills, and we never skimp on that, path, every day for 2 years.
Yeah.
I think that would work.
Yeah,
I think it would be a better... You don't have to not do the one you're already doing, but you can specialize a true path that works.
Yeah, as long as you're working on those basic fundamentals of every other area at the same time.
We're doing a half-hour a day. We're sacrificing a half-hour from some other thing, whether that is some of your strength and conditioning or it's, you know, whatever it is, and it is the path.
Yeah.
And that path is 6 days a week, 12 months a year for 2+ years.
Yeah.
That path, we can make that path work. Cody McKenzie, with very little training, not only won MMA fights, he got to the UFC and won UFC fights. He just created a path.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I truly think the next person who tries this, and they shouldn't be doing it with a shortcut mentality, they should be doing it with an in addition to doing everything else mentality.
Yeah, that's crucial.
I think that's the way to get somebody in the shortest time possible. And I really think if CM Punk were to win this fight, and we're talking about on Monday, it's probably a submission. They've worked every day for 2 years. And they don't talk about it on TV.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That might be a guillotine. It'd be the easiest one to teach.
Yeah.
It'd be a heel hook.
Yeah.
But that's a lot harder to teach.
It is.
So if you're watching this Tuesday and he didn't get knocked out by this young kid or rear naked choked and he found a way, it's a submission they worked on for 2 years. You know?
Most likely.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to what you said. First off, with the Tim Ferriss stuff, that's great stuff. Erickson, the guy, the deliberate practice guy, Gladwell kind of hacked all that stuff with the 10,000 hours, but that's not what he was getting at. The actual psychologist who did the papers and did the studies and stuff. It's about deliberate practice.
Right.
That's
and
what
first
it's about.
We figure out what deliberate practice is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And actually, that's what you need to be doing to improve those skills and to become, able to kind of hack how you improve at things quicker. So it's not necessarily 10,000 hours. It's not. It's that deliberate practice.
Right.
That's what Ferriss is talking about. That's what Erickson was talking about. And like you said, and Eddie Bravo touched on this. I heard him talking about it on Rogan's podcast where he was watching Demian Maia, that fight against Condit, and he's talking about that path and that route to victory and that route to the back. He does the same. He's figured out the best way of getting, he wants to get to half guard and then he looks to get to quarter mount and then he'll kind of take the back from there when you turn, gets the choke in. He's got it figured out what the route is.
That's 17 years of him building that route. We have 2 years to build it on against a low level guy. But
exactly.
It's
the same idea and it's the same principles and Maya has it everywhere. He's a black belt.
30 routes off of 30 routes off of 30.
But he tends to be kind of following that with recent fights. And it does make sense. And once you're working on those fundamentals everywhere, and those fundamentals are everything, that's all Maya does is just fundamentals better than everyone else. But it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. I'd love to see that project.
Yeah.
I would love to be part of that project.
Me too.
If there's someone out there who wants to do it, get in touch with us.
Yeah, we want to do it.
Yeah, but that would be so cool to see. But then, for that to work, that path on that night, when it counts, mentally you need to be prepared.
Yeah,
you need to be aware too of the pressure that's there, and it's silly to pretend there's no pressure.
We're going to deal with the mentality as we're building the path.
100%.
We're going to deal with it. Also, deliberate practice. We need feedback from someone qualified, watching as a third person. We need it to almost redline our level, really be beyond our capabilities almost every time. So it's a hard project. We need higher level guys, as you start to be able to do it to people, you need to do it to harder and harder tests, and we need to deal with the psychology of that.
Yeah.
But it is, you can build a fighter at that level, at the low levels, and then you use Demian Maia, who's already a 99 jiu-jitsu and an 89 or 90 everywhere else, built those paths on top of all of his other skills.
Yeah.
Josh Barnett uses a path.
Yeah.
Josh Barnett has always used. He has many paths, but if he gets to the point where you're down, he gets the mount, he beats you up, he takes your back, he smashes you, he keeps that mount, the head and arm choke comes.
Yeah, head and arm.
You know?
Yeah, he sets it up.
There's many like that. And Gunnar's been like that at times in his life, you know?
I know from watching high-level coaches like we had John on last week and seeing the way John kind of coaches a class with the sequences they work on, you know, it's not as complicated as it might appear when you get down to what the fundamentals are and what you need to get done. The sequences are not that not that complex, you know?
And there's a, for people who don't study jiu-jitsu, on some level, and this applies to why it's so great to study martial arts, it applies to many areas of life, but it applies to other martial arts, it applies to, there's a flow chart of options. Whether you do it consciously, some coaches have you draw out your flow chart.
Yeah.
And other times, as you go here, that doesn't work, but it gives you this, and then you try that, and that doesn't work. Oh, it does work. It works for a while, but eventually someone shuts you down, and you slowly develop your flow chart out into the world. But it's an interesting idea. Now, the deliberate practice, we can't just say, I'm going to do guillotines 1,000 times for 2 years at home alone, although Cody McKenzie kind of did that. So it's not you can't do it, but not as effectively as if you have true coaching, true deliberate practice, true mentality, real commitment, real understanding of yourself, learning to improve your systems and learning to learn better and all of those things. We're still building, but we have a path in mind as we're building all of the roots.
Yeah, and that was something that John Kavanagh and myself were looking at doing with one of those, with Erickson to work on something like that. We're working on real deliberate practice for MMA. Mm-hmm. So that's something I'm hugely fascinated by. And what you're describing there, that kind of, that path. So there, no one, like, you're not going to in 18 months or 2 years become, you know, a Wonder Boy or a Conor McGregor.
You're
or
not going to become the
Demetrius
lowest level
Johnson.
Fighter in all of the UFC.
Yeah.
Okay, so no matter what CM Punk does for the rest of his life, he can't become the second worst fighter in the UFC.
Yeah.
And maybe not the rest of his life. At 42, he and somebody not very good is in there. But to go from nothing and no, you can't, he'll never be the second worst fighter in the UFC.
Yeah.
He will always be the worst just based on ability to what you can learn in that time.
And that's not what this fight's about. This is an experience fight for him. This is him having an experience, a life experience that he was in a position to be able to do.
Yeah.
Lots of people out there would love to do it. He's a fan of the sport. Lots of fans of the sport would love to be able to have an opportunity to do it. He was in a position from his wrestling that, to be able to do that. So he did it.
Yeah.
And it's an experience he'll have, and hopefully he gets something out of it, as in show some heart, you know, fights out of something or reverses or whatever it might be.
I would hope for him to have a great night as somebody who went through it. But and I don't ever hope for a guy to lose, but he will certainly get more. If he were to find some way and something goes wrong and there's a banana peel slip, it will nowhere near give him as much quality of life, as much as he's going to grow from it and learn in his life, as if he overcomes some challenges of the fight and then loses.
Yeah.
That's going to give him the best return in a lifetime of growth, is to, and then go back and deal with that. Because for a guy who only 2 years ago showed some fear of being judged at all, to now overcome a loss will be so valuable.
For sure. But like, to me, that's what this is. This is just an experience that someone is having.
Yeah.
And they've marketed it well, so people are going to watch. Mm-hmm. But the guy at the other end, you know, he has a pressure on it. I heard Jim Miller talking about it. Jim Miller's one of his coaches. And so it's good to have someone like that around who's you know, fought at the very top level and fought pretty much everyone in the division and had wins and had losses and had great nights and been in fights of the years and all those kind of things. And he talked about the pressure and that how Mickey Gall is handling it so well and all the different stuff. But he wanted to make sure that his guy is aware that the pressure is there. There's no point pretending it's not.
No, that's good.
Because then it's going to sneak up on you in the night.
Yeah.
But if you're admitting that there is a pressure with this, you're expected to go out there and not just beat this guy. This should be over within 45 seconds. This should be over real, real quick.
It's a lot of pressure.
So it is. There is a unique pressure on that one, and it is a strange kind of a situation for a guy who's 1-0 to have that. But that's the reality. Mm-hmm. So he's talked about acknowledging that. So that to me says that he's going to be prepared for that, and that camp have got him ready for that. That pressure that exists.
So the first, 6 months, I had a knee-jerk reaction the way many of the average person did. It's like, this is ridiculous. Why isn't this? All that stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm really happy over the last while. You know, nothing changed. I still understand will be the worst skill level fighter that we've ever seen. There's no way he could not do that, but who cares? My job, I am a enormous UFC fan, but my job is to find something, some analysis or some learning or some study. And I'm really, even the fact, like some people would say, my God, you spent so much time talking about an 0-0 fighter. It's because if you look at these unique situations, this has nothing to do with this guy. The only thing we've talked about him is the pressures he experienced and my personal hope that he had a good thing and your observation of, you know, what he's doing and how, and why he's doing it. But the we get this unique chance to study this very rare and odd situation and analyze it out of interest, but also learn things from it.
Yeah.
You'll apply things from looking at this really bizarre situation to your job.
Yeah.
You've never had, no matter how big of situations you've had with your fighters, you've never had this one. So you get to, I mean.
Yeah, not like this.
Not like this. But you've worked with a fighter that had, you've worked with many debuting fighters.
Yeah, yeah. And lots of guys with on both sides of this experience. And it is fascinating. Just alone, if you learn nothing from it, it's just a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
But the benefit will be there are things to learn from it. And it is an interesting one to look at, that thing for the need to achieve and the need to avoid failure. It's a unique kind of a fight with that. But that can be there for every single fight.
Yeah.
You know, you would think that all UFC fighters are more need to achieve than they are need to avoid failure. But not all of them.
And every fight's different.
And every scenario is a different scenario. That's the key. It's not, these are not constants. These relate to the situation. So Overeem and Stipe have, you know,
Verdum had a need to avoid failure in Brazil.
Yeah, you know? Like having a belt.
Yeah,
can immediately change the fight before you, when you were going for the belt. You know, it automatically can be a little bit more a goal that you've been working toward. You get the title shot, you wanted it, you get it, and you have this need to achieve. You're taking on this challenge. You're ready to go and put it all out there. When you have the belt, all of a sudden that can just change everything immediately. And then it becomes about, well, I've got something to lose now. And it can become a little bit, you can tilt, the balance can tilt towards needing to avoid the failure more so than needing to achieve. And goals don't get reset with guys. And we've seen it a lot recently with belts changing hands pretty quickly in lots of different divisions. And a lot of that is that mental. A lot of it is the fact that the playing field is really level, and the level has come up in the sport. But a lot of it too is that fighters who gain the belts don't readjust their thinking and their mindset around it.
That example we made earlier of Jones and OSP. In most of Jones's fights ever, he's shown himself to be a need to achieve.
Yeah,
like
risk taker.
Risk, always more, always accomplish more, always go further,
yeah.
Always create within the fight, all those things.
Taking on guys at their game, you know, beating Chaelas in wrestling, beating, you know, just taking guys on at what they do.
And then against OSP, he admitted feeling different.
Yeah.
So even that, these are the same as we say, it's like, you know, you don't have, Matt Brown said, I'm not mentally strong. I'm just a guy who prepares to put himself in a situation. And he's mentally one of the strongest people we observe. But it's something he has to keep working on.
Yeah.
But also, you know, John Jones isn't eternally driven to succeed, because in certain situations he will experience that will change and it'll be unfamiliar. Some people coming off a suspension or coming off an injury or, you know, the last fight of their contract or any of those things, the situation can shift how they view the task.
Yeah, 100%. Like it does. And that's one of the main things I do. Like, I've been breaking down what I do with guys just for myself, just to get a structure in my head, because I have it all in my head, get it out of my head and onto some paper and know exactly how I do what I do.
Which will let you analyze your own work and optimize.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's why I'm doing it. But I have those fundamentals of controllables and non-controllables and different things like that around that happens with everyone, and we're working on those constantly on self-talk and visualization and all the different things that we work on. But most of the work is getting ready for this fight, and this fight has a unique challenge compared to the last fight. What is that unique challenge? What is this task now? How are you looking at this task? Is it the best way of looking at it? So that happens all the time. And then during training, get an injury, so you have to miss 2 weeks of training now. And that's part of this experience now. Mm-hmm. That's part of this fight. That can shift that mindset. So we're constantly working on making sure that were at optimum in terms of the mental state going into the fight.
You just have made me think of something interesting from what you do, and it relates to what fighters do and to what a lot of people do, is over time, the more that you're working, you see, oh my God, something weird and unpredictable happened. You see enough weird and unpredictable, and it no longer is weird and unpredictable.
Yeah.
It becomes, we exist in a paradigm that the unpredictable is commonplace.
Yeah.
So it changes how you view unpredictable. Also, you know, oh my God, I've never had a guy have diarrhea after the weigh-in before. Well, now you have.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I've never had a guy whose mother is sick the day of that. Well, now you have. And you get more and more and more experiences like that. How does that shift? And this, the more you learn, the more experiences you have, the less things seem random and unpredictable, and the more you've experienced that. How does that change for the fighter, for you, for me at my job, for anybody at their jobs? What do we have to do different as we start to learn that?
We have to take on board those experiences. And like, I, as much as I do a review with the fighter themselves, I do a review of myself after the camp or after the fight. Okay, what happened there? What can we take from that? For myself, for the work, for future things that crop up. And it's not just, okay, wait, if that happens to another guy, we'll do this. You have to take into account the personality differences between the fighters as well and the situational differences around the fight. But it's impossible to map out every single scenario that might happen. But there are similarities and different patterns that you see. And as much as everyone is individual and different, they're more similar than they're not.
Yeah.
And I'm better now at what I do than when I started. I'm much better.
I've
been thinking about this, where I almost not feel bad for the fighters I started with, but if I was back with them now, it would be different.
Yeah,
it'd be better. It'd be different. I'm better at what I do now. Mm-hmm. But I had to go through those experiences 100%. To get to this point. Luckily, they've stuck with me.
Yeah.
So that helps.
Yeah.
People who are new to me now, it's a very different process than it would have been 7-6 years ago, whatever it was when I started really working with guys. It's a much more I know how to cut out what's irrelevant, basically, from what I was doing.
Right.
It's not so much adding stuff in, it's cutting stuff out.
Right. Yeah, and that's what efficiency and optimization is.
Yeah.
This will tie back. I don't know. We've maybe been almost an hour already, which always happens. But this carries back to that, avoiding failure. That really kind of paralyzes a lot of people. Sometimes, because the world moves quickly, and fighters are better than they've ever been. We're just going to use them for an example because that's what we talk about. So to start fighting now, your first day you do whatever, you're just so far from Alistair Overeem.
Yeah.
That it seems, if you think about the long path and how much work it's going to be and how many times you're going to be asked to try and fail, it's daunting. But it's just starting as a thing. Like when I watch things and I see people comment on things and you see, Gary Vaynerchuk or one of these guys who does these things where they try to teach people how to do whatever it is they're doing. You always see people going, how do you get motivated? How do you start? And it's a very strange thing. You want people to just start things.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, and you...
There's never going to be a perfect time.
Yeah. In fact, now's the perfect time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, now is the exact perfect time, whatever it is. But there's this paralyze. It's something, and you don't judge any single person because you see it so much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's something cultural that's artificial. It's not real, but it has created this feeling that we're scared to start things.
Yeah.
And the only answer to it is to start things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And procrastination is, the small procrastination, oh man, I don't want to do the dishes now, is somehow similar.
Yeah.
But procrastination is a very powerful and useless thing.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. One of my buddies was talking about starting jiu-jitsu for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, just go to a class. Then once you do, you'll
do jiu-jitsu
now. You'll keep doing it.
You'll,
and he was putting offers along, and I need to get in shape first. I need to get fit. And I was like, this will get you fit.
Yeah, exactly.
Doing it will get you fit for doing jiu-jitsu. And you're not going to be any good at the start. You know, you're not going to be any good.
But neither has every person who's ever started.
He started at the start of the summer. Yeah. And he's become one of those jiu-jitsu addict people.
Yeah.
And that's great. He loves it now and he's doing it. And then he started talking, I think I'm going to do a tournament. I'm going to jump in and do a tournament.
Right.
And I was like, just do it. Have the experience. Do it. And then he's like, yeah, but I'll need to have a lot of mat time before I do that. And I'm not sure that I'm going to be like the stuff coming up with work and different things.
He's already been afraid to start to do something, but then upon doing it, got really great results.
Yeah.
But that natural inclination
for the next step is. But then again, it's that thing of what, like, you just go on, because the longer you put it off, the bigger thing it becomes of mm-hmm. actually competing.
Yeah.
Go and do it. Go and compete and have that experience. And then it'll be, you know, you'll see that for what it is. Like you remember your first fight, your first tournament you've done in martial arts, and it's very different to one the later ones. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of you get an idea of what it really is, then, and it starts to become, it changes what it is. But it's just a matter of, like you said, just at a certain point, motivation is a little overrated, and you just kind of have to get on with it and do it.
Yeah, there's almost like, how do you stay motivated? You don't. You just do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But once you start things, it changes the way that you live your life. You become somebody who can do things,
mm-hmm.
who can start things, who can change things, you know? And it's one of those things, I know it's like, you can't influence everybody. In fact, you can't influence many, but you're just like, if just a couple of people said, yeah, why don't I start that thing I've said I'm going to start for a long time? They would just... But it is not an individual thing. It's a strange, hard to define cultural thing that has shifted.
But we can
and
see it
shape.
So we can see it so much. And coming back to the CM Punk fight, it's a good example of why people don't take things on because of the hate that guy's getting for taking on a challenge that he's taken on.
Yeah.
You know, and people want to see him lose and want to like why?
But well, so this why? Why is it hard to try things? Because the cost of failure has become public ridicule.
Yes.
Why is the cost of failure public ridicule? The same reason people don't try things. It's a self-fulfilling thing. You're going to try something, I'll ridicule you. Why will I ridicule you? Because you're trying something I'm scared to try. And it just perpetuates itself until you have a paralyzed society. It's a very strange thing. But yeah, once you think about it that way, you're right. It's like you want to encourage people to try things. The truth is... one of the steps that needs to be taken is understanding that, you know, if somebody says you're a stupid head on the internet, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
That doesn't... It's part of our nature to think it means something, but it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know? And I know that that's become a part of your job now.
It
wouldn't have been
that.
10 years ago.
Yeah,
wouldn't have been 15 years ago. It would have been like, oh, the audience might think this.
Yeah.
But, oh, I might get a letter that somebody sat down and wrote. But now, you know, it must be really hard for some 21-year-old athletes.
Yeah, some guys, it's a part of it. I remember when I started, it was more forums. Because in Ireland back then, MMA was... If you said MMA to someone, they wouldn't know what it was. It was the cage fighting stuff.
Right.
Other than a small little group of people that were in, like, if you were a fan of it, you were probably involved in it somehow. That's how small the community was, and that grew over the years. But it was a forum thing, and people would be talking on forums. There's some great, if someone could find them, there's some great stuff on forums. Conor McGregor shit talking on forums back in 2009, 2010. It was great stuff. But, like, people would have a go at you, and I remember having to ban a fighter from going on forums just because I was like, why are you going on it then?
Yeah.
You know, what's this doing for you? What are you getting out of it? What are you getting out of it? And it was, you know,
it's
they were getting
addiction.
Nothing out of it.
He was addicted to the conflict.
Yeah, getting nothing out of it, only negative, and taking on that emotion. So while we were working on how to manage that, we also cut it off,
right?
You know, because that was a controllable. You could just not go on there anymore. But and at the same time, work on how to manage that better, because it's as you, like fighters want to move up the ladder. You know, this is one of the things I'm always talking about when you're making next steps. Hang on, you want this next step. Nobody dreams of fighting. Well, some guys do, but serious fighters who get into the sport, they dream of making it to the UFC, of headlining cards in
and
Vegas.
And then being the top 20, and the top 10.
So if that's true, if that's what they want, then they do want this added pressure. They do want these added eyes and this added attention. So you can't turn it off forever. So we have to be working on managing that and knowing what the little traps are coming around the corner. If you know, you can be working on that as you're climbing up the ladder. But that early on step was just to cut it off, because that was possible to do. But yeah, that's something that it's a real thing. You know, it's a real thing. And fighters, there's the tendency to put up the big posts after the fight,
right?
You know, on social media, like thanks to these and shout out to these and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And that comes after a win. And then after a loss, it's a different kind of a post, and there's different kind of comments afterwards, and you have to all that stuff is part of it now for a fighter.
It is, and somebody, I was talking to a friend of mine, Albert Chang. He fought in UFC China. Yeah. He's in the neighborhood, and I see him a lot. He's a great fighter, and he's on a 3 or 4 fight win streak. And we were talking about that kind of thing. He's like, "Oh man, they've been saying things about you forever." And for me, it was very interesting because I accepted it before I started, and I don't know where CM Punk is at with it, but it was like, they're gonna hate you. And you'd hate you in this situation. You would look at this and go, what's going on here? Now, I was fighting exactly where I belonged.
Yeah.
An undercard of a low-level thing against a guy with one fight or whatever. And even still, because of where you came from. So I just kind of accepted it. But he was joking about it, and I was laughing at some things. And then he talked about how friends of his, it really hurts them. And I said, and he said, but, you know, I was talking to a buddy of his, and he said, but I was talking to him, and, you know, he admitted they pay their tickets, and just the same way that, like, hockey fans would scream, shoot the puck, this guy will scream, kick him in the head. And I said, absolutely, absolutely. They are fans of fighting. They have every right to say anything they want. And you have every right to not be affected by it.
Yeah.
You have every right to have it be meaningless to you. But it's something that I've noticed over the years is, as much as you do want to appreciate somebody saying something nice or sharing a nice idea, it cannot feed you.
Yeah, I know.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if you're going to let somebody feed you by saying, oh, bro, you're the best fighter I've ever seen, then you are acknowledging feedback from people you don't know. And that's going to allow when people go, bro, you're the worst fighter I've ever seen, that, like, you have to not let either feed you.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
100%.
Yeah.
You have to see that stuff for what it is, but you're in charge of, like, that is one of the controllables, is your reaction to that stuff.
That's a whole, that we've talked about it a few times on the show, and we'll definitely revisit it. But being, people don't necessarily, depending what stage of understanding your control of your own emotions and reactions people are, they may disagree with that.
Yeah.
Well, this guy said this, so that's all. That's still on you. But that is, and something we'll revisit in as we explore fights. It's a theme that matters a lot to me. Learning that how you respond, if your girlfriend or your wife or your brother or your best friend says something to you and you're mad, and when somebody says, why are you mad? And you say, well, they said this, that suggests that you don't have control of your emotion.
Yeah.
Somebody called you a name, therefore you punch them in the face.
Yeah.
People, evolved people, somebody calls you a name and you choose your reaction, whatever it is. But that's something, depending how far down understanding your own emotions you are, this may sound like nonsense to you, or you might go, of course.
But it's something that can be worked on.
Yeah.
And emotional intelligence can be improved with awareness and everything like that. And again, that's part of what I'm doing with guys as well, is just getting them more aware of how much control they have over things that maybe they left up to chance before. That's a huge part of it, you know, of like even down to the most important part, which is their mindset when they're walking out. Their mindset when they're in the fight, you know, the fight's about to start now. Where are you?
Yeah.
Where are you really mentally?
Yeah.
Where are you right now? That lots of guys leave it up to chance, and they never realize the control they actually have over that, and how they can manage that so that they're at that optimum mindset, ready to go and deliver a performance.
Telling you, I've fought 9 times. The 9th, after all the things I learned, I would wish I could go back and fight with the things I had learned, but I would have never learned the things I learned.
Yeah,
you never would. But There was a few that it just felt so good that you had this chance to do this thing. It was like you've never been more alive. And then if you don't have control of it, there's other ones where just every possible thing is going wrong in your head. And you learn to control it, but it can be the greatest thing in the world. It really can, but it can be the most terrifying, too.
It can. And simple things, and like from watching that show, the CM Punk show, mm-hmm. I love the way Duke, just like, I know editing is its own beast, and that's what the show is. It's entertainment and stuff. But just the little bits you're getting from Duke Rufus, it's great stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
Duke's brilliant. I had him on the podcast last week, and I don't know if you got a chance to see.
It's great stuff.
It was really, really cool. Duke's a really cool guy, and if I was to get to fight again, I'd want Duke in my corner.
Yeah, just even breathing, just reminding the guy to breathe. Yeah. And that's huge. That's huge, you know, in certain moments during the fight or before the fight and stuff like that. Just simple things like that. You can take control and become a little bit more present just by breathing.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, he said, you know, he was careful how he put it, but he was like, you know, if you are, he didn't say these exact words, but essentially, if you're outskilled in MMA, you can create chaos. And it's, if that's some of the thinking, and it is at least some of it, it's a rough way to go into something that even if I did everything exactly right, if I'm thinking a lot and I'm running plays and I'm trying, it may not work as well as if I just go for it.
Yeah.
And that's a hard way. That's why this is a hard fight for that guy.
Yeah, 100% it is.
But, I mean, by the time you're watching this, he might have just had the greatest debut ever. But it's, for me, as an observer, the greatest potential experience for him would be to be tested and pushed, pass a few small tests, lose the fight and find out he's, you know, obviously he's not as skilled, and then get the experience of failure, realize failure is nowhere near as bad as 99% of us think it is, and carry on.
To me, the fact that he's going to go in there and do it, he's you can't say failing anymore, because the training and the work and the actual making that walk and all that goes into that, he'll have done that. So then it's another level. It's not failure anymore when he's actually gone in and done it. Then it's another level of what you evaluate the performance itself.
Yeah. There's already many, 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 many successes.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. So we're going to go get a beer in a couple of minutes. But there's cool fights coming up. Lawler versus Cowboy Cerrone.
That's a crazy fight.
Yeah, really crazy fight. Robbie Lawler was blowing our minds with his mental performances coming in, and he's going to have to do it in a new way coming off of being knocked out after being in such a role.
Yeah, and that performance against Woodley wasn't, like, it was, you can call it what you want, a quick knockout and stuff, but he wasn't at Robbie Lawler level mentally in that fight. He just wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Not yet.
No, I could see
he didn't start that way, and he never got to go anywhere.
He never got a chance to get going, but he wasn't in that usual set and mindset that it's hard to, all you can do is see what you're seeing. You can't be in his mind to know what it is, but it just from observing, it didn't look like he was in that same state. Even I was saying that before he got knocked out, so he has to evaluate what happened there, what was going on in the build up, who knows what was going on. There can be multiple reasons for that. But he needs to evaluate, find out what happened there. He needs to, make sure that he's ready for this challenge and has a new goal now. You know, a new target. He's not just fighting to get the taste of the last one out of his mouth. And instead, he's got, if his target is to get the belt back, that's great. And this is a step towards that. You know, if that's what that is. But having reset his goals, taken on the lessons from the loss, understanding that he didn't just get caught with a shot. He didn't perform. He wasn't in the same state. Whatever, you know, all the different things that were there. Find out what's happened, and then getting excited about this challenge and what this brings, because this is you know, a unique challenge again. And it's completely different now for him.
It's true. So we're going to talk about this more next time. We're also going to talk about Cowboy, because there's a lot to do with, there's a lot. And I have some insight that I can give you. Maybe I've told you a bit, but I don't think I have in the show, of seeing him in Ottawa a lot. I saw him and his coaches, his prep, his walk. I saw a lot of it. And so I have some good insight for you next time. Before we go, I just want to challenge you to something. You were talking about going back and studying your own things. Mm-hmm. And if, so when we're watching fights, and I don't, you know, you've specialized even deeper into the mentality and psychology, and you have an adult lifetime of that in this sport. I studied the sport itself on as many different ways and the physiology and all of these things as I can. But I can, and we've agreed on, I know you can even more, when they come out, we can see if they're turned on or not. And before we spoke, as Ronda walked out for the Holly Holm fight, and she wasn't, the mindset wasn't there. It's not a switch. It's not as simple as an on or an off switch, but it was not there.
It was different.
Verdum, we saw that. Connor against Diaz, Rockhold against Bisping, we saw that. And there was an example.
And Lawler against Woodley.
Those were real. Some of them we were texting or speaking to each other during. It's not a coincidence. There is something, and there are many things we're seeing by, you know, tens of thousands of hours of study and experience and your personal experience and all of that. I challenge you to, if you can, examine how and what it is you're looking at.
I've been doing that. I've been doing that myself because...
What I'll call a thin slice.
Yeah.
We're going to thin slice what it is. Now, why? We don't know yet. How we're going to discuss it? We don't know yet. But... together, I don't end because we've done 100 of these shows or whatever. I'm not 100% sure there's anybody more qualified as a team to try to thin slice down what it is we're looking at, and I want to do that.
Yeah, it's something I've been, because I said it, I was out for the Lawler-Woodley fight, and I said it to one of the lads that I was out with, like, Lawler's not right here. He's not in the same state. And it's not like you can see it for every fight. And it's not like I'm some kind of genius that can predict and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. This is why I want to do it. And it's something that I've started to realize when I talk about a fight analysis and technique and whatever. My whole point isn't to say, oh, I'm some mystical guy with his crazy breakdowns. My point is to go, this is here. Let's demystify it so that everybody can see it. Because once upon a time, people didn't know how to watch baseball. Once upon a time, they didn't know what a pump fake was in football.
Yeah.
These are now just as mystical and weird. And there are people who do my job who would like you to believe that they're some deep mystical, have some sense.
Yeah.
This is just fighting. It's there.
Yeah.
It's all there. So I'm not saying, hey, we can do something crazy. We predict these things. What I'm saying is there is distinct and concrete evidence available to the mindset that they're in, and I want to narrow some of it down.
Yeah. I said it to him that night. I said Lawler's not there, and he said after the knockout, he was like, "What? What did you see?" And I was like, "Great question."
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what I see when I see it. But there's something there sometimes, and it's not like every fight. And it's just all I can compare with is them to themselves.
Exactly.
I'm not looking for things that. Like, he looks a certain way or he stands. It's comparing Lawler to Lawler.
That's a great
point. Comparing
Connor
to Connor, Ronda to Ronda before. That's what I'm looking at. So you can only see it for, like, Aldo against Edgar, to me, looked very different than Aldo against Connor.
Yeah. You know what's weird?
In a good way.
I did this comparison, now I'm just realizing, going on 4 years ago or whenever I started doing breakdowns, Uriah Faber and the alpha posture.
I saw
years
that.
Back and about how and I didn't know exactly what I was seeing, but through study we're looking for truths to share. And seeing the posture that people took, you could see certain things, and I compared it to the posture of animals and stuff. And it's not, these things develop over time. Things you believed were so, we will be happy to find out we were wrong as we gather more information. But I compared Cerrone and Cerrone.
Yeah.
Cerrone against Pettis, and then Cerrone in his next fight. And you, I don't know what it is, but it was by comparing them to themselves.
Yeah, that's all you can never do.
And it's very hard. We may not be able to exactly go in and say it's a certain posture, it's a certain eye behavior. It may not be any of those things. It might be if you love fighting enough and you're engaged in it deep enough and you watch it enough, you'll be able to make that comparison.
Yeah, it's something I've become. I want to know what it is myself. Mm-hmm. So I want to figure out what it is I'm looking at. But and even more so if it's something that, you know, can be addressed then for me with fight. But it's in that Blink, Gladwell's book.
Yeah.
He touches on that with someone who can observe a painting and just say that's a fake.
Right.
You know, just how do they know? What is it that they can see?
Right.
And it could be a brilliant fake. It could be just, but and it would fool most of the people. But the expert, the true expert, can can tell the difference. Mm-hmm. And that was true for lots of different things. So,
very true. And what we're asking is, how can we figure out? So we know we can do it.
Yeah.
And we know many others do it. But it may be hard to get that down, because you'll, without certain bits of information, it can't be thin sliced enough. Or you say, anytime somebody's looking down, that means
that's
true.
Not what it is, yeah.
Unfortunately, the goal to demystify can't always be achieved. And often, as soon as we have this conversation, there will be others trying to find the answers.
And there are plenty of others out there who have seen the same things.
Most coaches.
Yeah, who have seen the same things. They'll know a guy who's not switched on. I've had coaches say to me, you could tell he was going to put in a good one tonight. But what is that? What is that thing? It's not just the way they're talking. It's not just, there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's something I've been looking at myself, so I want to get more into that. Fight Pass, I can do that now.
Yeah.
You know, you can look back over different things and see. That's something we can delve into a little deeper somehow.
But let's be careful, not ourselves, but not to have ask people to, and we're not asking anybody to do anything, but people's... will go, oh, I know what it is. It's the shoulders, but it isn't one thing. It isn't even three things.
Yeah,
that was a great, the counterfeit comparison is a great one. And in Blink, he could point out that somebody who was studying two people who were, a couple, husband and wife or whatever.
Yeah.
He could look at them and look at a couple of, ask them three or four questions and then say, predict to like 98% accuracy
together
whether they'd
be
together or not.
Yeah.
And of course, Malcolm Gladwell tried it over and over again. And well, is it this? Oh, well, he said her name this way. And over time, and this has to be studied for 20 years to find out if you're accurate enough. And his was, if either one of them, while the other one says something, rolls their eyes.
Yeah.
Because the eye roll is such a powerful sign, genetic sign, meaning you're not welcome in the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been there in our, that it undermines the conversation so powerfully that if you do it long enough over time, you will make the other leave you.
Yeah.
Or you'll leave them because they will respond so poorly. It's a very interesting thing. But that one could be thin sliced down to literally an eye roll that this expert, after enough time, could recognize that was it. And I don't think this is that, because the counterfeit couldn't be.
Yeah, there's a lot of different factors, mm-hmm. I'm sure, but it is something that's fascinating to see. And it's not just on a negative side, it can be on the positive side. Like Conor against Nate Diaz in the second fight, as he begins, he's walking as the camera's backstage and it hits him.
Yeah.
And everyone's waiting for him to do that smirk thing that he does, and he doesn't do it. It's not that he didn't do it. It's not the fact that he didn't do it. It's the fact that he was switched on. I could see he was ready to go.
Yeah.
He was in a different state, whereas the fight before that, he did it because that's what he does.
Right.
Before, he was doing it because that's what he was feeling.
That's what he felt.
Yeah,
there's
a big difference.
Yeah.
And it sounds a bit woo-woo, and it sounds a bit bullshit, and it's getting away from... It sounds like that kind of prediction kind of thing, but that's not what we're getting at.
No, because people win not switched on, and people lose perfectly in their best state. So it isn't that. And nobody, if a few hundred people watch this through to the end, that they're seeing this part of the conversation, I would urge people to not try to bet based on somebody's
eyes or
anything like that. Also, if we can ever truly pinpoint this, we would make a theory in a year and find it wrong in 2 years, and it would change as people's own expressions change, and it would change as the dynamic between people change. So if you rush to figure out what it is, you will be 100% wrong.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing. We are just jerking ourselves off here at the end. Wow. Unreal. So I think it's time for us to get a beer. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for watching this masturbatory nonsense at the end. It was a lot of fun, to be honest. Thank you for the questions and the things on Twitter. I'm a Snapchat monster now. I'm all about it. I'm going to Snapchat this right now. Maybe I'm overdoing it. But Snapchat.
Why'd you say maybe there?
Yeah. Hold on. Maybe, yeah. And by maybe, Snapchat of us on the mentality of combat sports. Follow me on Snapchat. I don't know exactly how it works, but it's fun. David Mullins MMA on Twitter and Robin Black MMA on Twitter. Chase Kaiser on the board. Check out his website, davidmullinssportspsychology.com. And please send us some questions about like upcoming fights and aspects of upcoming fights. UFC 204. Oh, we didn't even talk about Bisping and Henderson. We'll get to that next time. Thank you guys so much for joining us.